You've heard that one before. That was the NHL on Versus or Outdoor Living Network, depending on how long you watched hockey in the United States. So, but that's definitely vintage era 2000s. So I wanted to bring that up because that's definitely where we're going to be, at least for part of this. But the book that we're talking about today spans a lot of time, but pretty much starts in the 2000s and goes over the last 20 years of hockey from the perspective of some great people inside of the game. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But I just want to start out by saying good day, everybody. How is everybody in Hockey Land today? I'm thinking pretty good right now, considering that the NHL's back. And so far, it looks like there's no shortage of action or storylines as expected. I'm just hopeful that as things keep progressing this season, that we see everything go as smooth as possible, and that hopefully by the end of the season, maybe the playoffs, more of us might have a chance to actually sit in the arena and watch a few things, as opposed to, and see the action in person, as opposed to only being able to watch it on TV. But that'll take time, and as we've seen already. With the Columbus Blue Jackets, they've had some COVID cases already that I just saw reported. So we could be in for a little bit of a time there until we get there. But obviously we'll get there sooner or later, and everything will be good. But still, for now, I'm just happy to see the great action on TV. Last couple nights have been great, and it's also great to have NHL TV, by the way, if you don't have that. So welcome to From the Point. That's what you're listening to right now. And as always, I just want to say many, 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 many thanks for tuning in. As always, I'm your host, Danny Lambert, and the reason we're here is to discuss another great book written about hockey. If this is your first time listening, just know that every week we take a great hockey book and have an in-depth discussion on the major themes of the book and talk a bit about the literary aspects of the book. If this is not your first time listening, thanks for making it back. Sorry for the repeat. As we've talked about many times before, it takes a lot more than great players to build a team. Oftentimes, you'll see that certain players play very well on one team and then fall off when moving to another team. Different teams have different cultures, different schemes or systems on how they play, and different teams often have different expectations on how the players need to perform. On a hockey team, there's always one man that controls those aspects in many cases, the coach. A great coach in hockey is often the difference in a team. You can have all the talent in the world on a hockey team, but if they can't work as a unit or simply if the players aren't properly motivated, then the team will not be successful. In the history of the game, there are plenty of examples where a great coach who is motivated, armed with great hockey sense, and able to motivate their players has brought a team that might have had no business being in the discussion into the forefront and in lots of cases emerging as the champions. It's about vision. A coach who has a vision for his hockey team is often successful. It's a vision that is rooted in experience and determination. If a coach can think about how to make his team successful and then communicate and motivate his team to follow that vision as a roadmap, that's when a team is really truly good, in my opinion. Bottom line, though, the coach of a hockey team is the one who motivates the team to success and gives the team the roadmap on how to get there, put quite simply. Every generation has their cast of those visionary coaches. I think of the 60s and 70s with names like Punch Imlach, Toe Blake, Scotty Bowman, Fred Shiro, and Harry Sinden, just to name a few. They are the visionaries that help players like Béliveau, Lafleur, Orr, Keon, and Clark realize their championship dreams. The argument can be said that, and I'm sure that these players would agree that even with all their talent, they would have not been as successful as they were if it were not for these great coaches that I just mentioned previously. So fast forward to where we are now, and over the last 20 years, we find such great coaches like Babcock, Quenneville, Hitchcock, and Julien. Sure, the players and the circumstances of the game have changed quite a bit, but the coaches of this modern era in the NHL have certainly left their lasting mark on the league and our memories for that matter. Capturing their stories and perspectives was something that the author of this week's book spent close to 2 years doing. It's quite a labor of love. Craig Custance sought out interviewed 10 different NHL coaches and watched some of their greatest wins with them to interview them to find out what made those teams and share some of the things that you may not know about themselves or the successes that or about the successful teams that they coached. It was a great journey and one that I enjoyed. So let's not waste any time anymore and jump into this week's book, Behind the Bench, Inside the Mind of Hockey's Greatest Coaches by Craig Custance. The warm-up is next.
Things have changed a lot. Hockey's gotten way better. You know, the game today is night and day different. And you can go back and you can talk about how great those players were in their generation. This is a different time. It's faster. It's better. It's more organized. It's harder. So to me, to compare them is different. In saying that, when Russia plays Canada, I think it's a big deal, and you want to have success. They want to have success, and we want to have success. Only one of us gets to leave tomorrow happy. Well, this is what I would tell you is I don't like to feed my family on hope. I like to feed my family on no. I don't like surprises, not on Christmas, not on my birthday. So I don't want any more. I want it under control.
That was an interview with Mike Babcock when he was coaching Team Canada in the World Cup that they had a couple years back. And what I found most interesting about that clip is just that Babcock's bluntness and the fact I like the speech about not liking surprises even in his personal life. Really sets a tone, and it really shows you kind of a little bit of philosophy. And that he's one of the featured people in the book that we'll be talking about a few times here during the episode, but I figured it was a good intro into what we were going to talk about today. So welcome to the warm-up. Just want to start out by, as always, I always say that, I know, I just want to start out by saying, if you ask players or coaches if they've gone back and watched any of the important games in their career, most would say no, they have not done that. I mean, why would they? Didn't they live it? But oftentimes, it's the re-examination of some of those moments that we often find the best stories come out. I guess there's something about seeing yourself doing something and just drumming up old feelings with the benefit of hindsight that makes for some awesome stories and commentary. That idea of hindsight to drum up some great commentary, I'm sure was on the mind of author Craig Custance when he devised the idea for his book, Behind the Bench. Custance takes his great idea and puts it into motion. The premise is that he would take the great NHL coaches of the era and watch some of their greatest victories on tape as fodder while he asks the different coaches their thoughts on the game today and in the past, as well as questions about their overall careers and philosophies. The result is exactly what you think. Custance gets some really awesome commentary from the hockey minds he interviews. And not only is he showing them the games that made them great in many cases, he's doing it in their own living rooms in some cases and getting a further glimpse into the man behind the coach. I really just love the mix of pure hockey talk mixed with a glimpse of the featured coach's life and his story of coming up in the coaching ranks. Also, not to mention the great stories of the players who were in the games that they were watching. Who else better to tell you about Sidney Crosby than Dan Bylsma and Mike Sullivan? Custance interviewed both of coaches, and both of them gave great insight into Crosby and those great Penguins teams of 2009 and 2016. And he didn't just seek out cup winners either. His interview with Ron Wilson about the 2010 Winter Olympics gold medal game was also pretty great. Then, if that wasn't enough, he gave you another side of that in the very next chapter after Wilson's. He interviewed Mike Babcock talking about the same game, just from the Canadian side of things. Additionally, what was not lost on me was the great backstory of the book itself. I felt like Custance did a great job to weave in his personal journey to complete the interviews in this book. He tells you just kind of what he had to do, like drive the family's minivan around and deviate from some of his family vacations just to be able to interview these gentlemen, which was really, really interesting. As mentioned before, it took him almost 2 years to complete the interviews and write the book. What he weaves into the book are the lengths that he needed to get the interviews, like the road trip he needed to take to find Babcock's cabin in Michigan, or meeting Todd McClellan on a boat dock gas station on Lake Okanagan. It was a labor of love that I really actually enjoyed hearing about, in addition to the different coaches he interviewed. The chase, as it was pretty cool. The formula of this book just really works. It was evident from the beginning that this was a similar yet different book. So when approaching a look into the book, I can tell you that it's not completely obvious about how to discuss what's in it, despite all the great information and insight that the coaches give. I mean, I could do an episode on each one of these coaches alone. Thus, I decided that it would be best to talk about the factors that help lead these coaches into the great moments that they experienced. To start off with it, I think it would be best if we just started to talk about the effects of the different players had on these different coaches. We've got 10 great examples to look into with some outstanding players that played underneath them. So without further delay, let's drop the puck on the first period and talk about how players affect a coach through their experiences and behind the bench. Stand by, that's up next after this.
I learned over time that the smaller the group, the better. So I would say probably now I use a group of four. And then if there's a secondary group, I meet with them individually. What's changed too in the leadership group is I don't think it's very difficult to be a good leader if you're not vocal now. Dressing rooms are much more quieter than they were in previous times. There's a lot of younger players, a lot more younger players on a team. So I think first of all, the player has to have a pulse of the team, number one, and I think being vocal is really important now because you need people in the locker room to say what everybody's thinking. And that's a very important term. And what I mean by that is that I think a lot of players know what's right and wrong, but you need people to bring that subject out in the locker room. So knowing who those players are and knowing that they can do that is really important. And if you have a younger player that's going to be a really good player and he's quiet, sometimes you can put him in the secondary group where you can work with him to become more confident and become more vocal.
So that was an interview with Ken Hitchcock. He was featured in the book as well. What I really like about that interview is the question that you don't see is he's explaining and he's answering just how he goes about making a leadership group on a hockey team and all the factors that go into it. So I really like that answer that he gave, but I really like the insight into his thinking most of all from that clip. So as mentioned earlier, you might already know every great player is often made or not made because of the coach. Oftentimes, the system of play established by a coach can either highlight a player's strengths or even, in some cases, strangle it. The culture that they build can make a good player better and, in many cases, a collection of otherwise mediocre players a championship-winning unit. Still, it cannot be understated just how much great players can make great coaches. And behind the bench, there are tons of stories from the coaches that Custance interviews of just how special some of the players were for them on the different championship teams that they coached. All of the coaches interview know it, and their stories reflect it. But what struck me the most is that many of the players that the coaches decided to single out to Custance were not necessarily the superstars on those different teams. Custance watched Game 6 of the 2010 Stanley Cup Finals with Joel Quenneville. It was the clinching game for the Blackhawks, and while there's some discussion about Kane and Taves, the biggest call-out to me that Quenneville gave was to Brian Campbell. Quenneville gives props to Campbell for a big poke check to help with the game-winning goal, and then later explains that he keeps the puck in the offensive zone at the end of the game, helping to sew the game up for the Hawks. Coach Q seems to remember the seemingly small contributions of the players that made such a big difference. Another story that was great in highlighting a coach believing in and remembering key contributors was when Bob Hartley trusted Dan Hynote to shut down Scott Stevens in Game 7 of the 2001 Stanley Cup Finals. Hartley knew that if he put Hynote on a line with Sakic and Tange, quote, Danny would forecheck like the devil. That was his job. End quote. And it worked out well, as in that game, Hynote kept Stevens off the two scorers. As a matter of fact, Hynote was so effective at his job, he was able to steal the puck from Stevens in the Devil's zone, which would lead Tange to score the first goal of the game, a game that we all know the Avs would go on to eventually win. One more way players have helped coaches of the book was through their excellent leadership. Sure, we've already said the coach is the leader of a team, but the players need a leader or leaders to help the coach realize his visions. The coach needs players to buy into what they want to do with the team, and a player with that, quote, follow me swagger that can make that a reality for the coach. Sometimes it's a gifted scorer taking the team on their back, or sometimes it's just a hard worker who shows others how to work on the ice by their example. Good coaches seek these leaders out and empower them to carry out their visions to win. These players often have to be the ones to tell the coach when and how to make the adjustments to their plans. The story I enjoyed most about a player leader who helped their coach, who was more in the camp of hard worker rather than scorer, was from the 1999 Dallas Stars. Sure, that team had firepower in the form of players like Mike Modano and Brett Hull, but their leader was most undoubtedly the rough grinder Guy Carboneau. In the 1999 Western Conference Finals, the Stars had just lost Game 5 to the Avalanche, and Ken Hitchcock was thinking that he needed to be more emotional and go after the pride of his players to get them motivated. Carboneau knew that Hitch needed to stay locked in on the game plan and how to preach it to the players, so he decided he would lead the charge to make sure that the Stars' hearts were in the game and give Hitch the ability to be able to execute his game plan to the best of his ability and preach it to the players so that they knew what was going on. The result, according to Hitch, was, quote, "We went into Colorado and we won. We played our best game," end quote. He continues that, quote, "The response was great. The players took care of the emotion. The players took care of all the effort," end quote. It can also be said that while many players work with and make a coach better, there are certainly players who end up getting in the way of their coaches in some cases. I was struck by the story of Vincent LeCavalier and John Tortorella when Torts was coaching Tampa Bay. Vinny was kind of a selfish player and was not considered much of a team player in his early days in Tampa Bay. Torts kept having meetings to push him, but they were in private. The issue was that the rest of the team thought LeCavalier was getting a pass. Torts decided to take his beef on with LeCavalier in front of the team, looking at their advice and what the team thought needed to be done. That became a big message to the team in the end, and it held Vinny to task. The relationship eventually grew between the player and the coach, and by the end of Torts' time with the Lightning, you know they ended up having great successes in Tampa Bay. And if that's not enough to explain the effect for coaches of a superstar player, the factor thing as well. In the book, I see two coaches that explain the effect of really one player. Both Dan Bylsma and Mike Sullivan were fortunate enough to have the same superstar who might be the best in the game today, Sidney Crosby. Both describe Crosby's effect almost in the exact same way. They explain how Sid's quiet, do-anything-play-hard-always attitude was obviously a key to the Penguins winning the Cup in 2009 and 2016. Sullivan describes Crosby's effect best by saying, quote, "His maturity level and his approach and the way he responded to some of the challenges we put in front of them were honest, straightforward challenges. He responded the right way and in every circumstance," end quote. So I think that's enough anecdotes to tell you really from the book, as I'm pretty sure you get it by now. Players can make or break a coach. Sure, there's a lot a coach can do to get things out of players, as we've seen, but sometimes it's just the player who responds to the coach or just believes in that coach. In the combination of the two camps, player and coach, that really make a winner. You have to have them working together, and as you can see, one can't do it without the other. So players have a big effect on coaches. I don't think anybody would doubt that. But as we keep the conversation going, I want to shift gears and examine how a coach's knowledge of the game can make a difference. So stand by as we get after great coaches and how their hockey smarts make their teams champions in the second period.
Today I will be talking about creating offense off the rush, our rush and entry habits and foundation. The skills and habits that we want to drill into our team and establish with this progression of drills is on our entry, a wide entry with speed and depth of attack. Depth of attack means getting down to the tops of the circles, attacking with the puck. Puck support, middle lane drive, which is at the strong side defenseman off his shoulder, and then to the net, that's our middle lane drive guy. And our dot wide, our third player entering dot wide, should be one step behind the middle-aged drive player and then dot wide to the net for a rebound in that area. And our second wave of attack, which would be our fourth guy, our strong side defenseman coming in here for our second wave, and our fifth guy coming on the weak side for our second wave of attack.
So to introduce the second period, when we're talking about systems, I wanted to find a good clip that really described a certain coach's thoughts on how to do more of the X's and O's part of the game. And I found that great clip from Danny Bylsma talking about how to create offense off the rush. So hopefully you'll learn something right there. I don't think anything was too terribly cosmic, but at the same time, it's really cool to hear a great coach like him talk about that. So that's how I want to start this period off. I think we can all agree that it takes more than just talent to win in sports. And of course, hockey is not immune to this fact. As Herb Brooks was known to say to his players who might have been getting a little too confident in their abilities, quote, "You don't have enough talent to win on talent alone," end quote. It's a blunt statement that seems harsh, but it has a reason behind that harshness. Brooks knew that in order for his teams to be successful, they needed to count on the system he was building, and that it took everyone on the team to buy into that system. We often see that great hockey coaches like Brooks have their way that they want the game to be played. As we've discussed in the last period, players are a big part of that, but they are nothing if they don't have any blueprints to follow to make success. Individuals don't win games, teams do, we know that, and plans are needed to win those games are supplied by great coaches. It's a system that coaches create, implement, and most of all, get the players to buy into. Some coaches have been more successful than others, but one thing is for sure, great coaches of great teams have a vision of how their team should play and the work that needs to be put in and the mechanisms that need to be put in place for that to become a reality. And behind the bench, I really clue into Custis's research into Coach Q to start this conversation. Part of Custis's research is not only to get fodder for the games with the coaches, but talking with former players and assistant coaches. In Quenneville's case, it was Mark Crawford, who was Coach Q's first head coach when he was an assistant. He explains that, quote, "Great players like Wayne Gretzky and Joe Sakic, they could see the plays develop." Joel has that kind of vision as well. That's what he has, and it's better than anybody else in the league. His vision is how he manages the bench. He doesn't miss things. He's the best I've ever seen, and he's a real fun guy. End quote. Quenneville is a great example of someone who knows how to spot those things in a game through his instincts and vision. But what makes the difference with him is that he's been able to take that vision and put it in place a system on his bench where he can counter the other team's game plans through line combinations that have said to be up to 3 to 4 different possibilities at any one given time, pretty much residing inside of Coach Q's head. But more importantly, he's doing it, as Crawford says, in a way that's fun so that players trust him and have a good feelings about Coach Q's abilities because they know he recognizes their talents and uses them to fit his vision in order to win. John Tortorella's system is a little more of a direct, less fun, but in many cases just as effective system. Much like Herb Brooks before him, Torts is known to be a bit abrasive and challenges players directly, often in public. The idea here is that Torts is looking to make his players show him that he's wrong and that the deficiencies he's pointing out are not deficiencies. Basically, he wants them to show them he's wrong and get to the level that Torts needs them to be for the team. Also, he's not worried about being liked. He's worried about winning. It's also about what you do to motivate players to be their best. As he puts it to Custance, he wants his players to know that he's being upfront with them. They know where they stand with him. He uses that upfront brashness to help his players as well, sheltering them from the press and other critics by making it about his decisions and not the players. Roberto Luongo, a player that many thought was mistreated by Torts, said it best to Custis when he explains, quote, "He doesn't think of anything other than winning the game. I thought he was a great coach, to be honest with you." It's just part of who he is, and that's fine. I accepted that, and it's led me to where I am today," end quote. But I think most importantly, for all the different ways a coach can run his team, successful coaches are the ones that evolve their strategies and attitudes to get the best out of their players. It's sort of a humility that makes them realize that they have a responsibility to lead and that they need to keep the end goal in mind of winning over their own desires. And the book Custance's Profile of Claude Julien is the best example of this style of coaching. Julien is so many are quick to point out Julien's humble nature. It's served him well as far as how his players see his motivations. They see a very humble man. They understand he has their best intentions in mind. But what stood out to me was how they explained his evolution in Boston when he was coaching the Bruins. It was said that he began his time in Boston as a bit of a micromanager. But by the end of his tenure there, he was able to give the game more over to his team. And as many of you know, those Bruins teams were certainly capable. I just found that to be a big aspect to a successful system, growing to change the system to meet the strengths and abilities of your players. Julien could have continued to try and make talented players like Bergeron and Marchand play his way, but he learned that they can play their own way and that he just needs to enable them to do that rather than control them. That's a hard lesson sometimes, and it's a way that doesn't work for every team, but it worked for the Bruins, and it took Julien's keen mind to realize that that was the way to go eventually. So, system of coaching is big, obviously, as we've just explained, but where does that system often come from? Where inside the coach do they decide that they want to go a certain way with their team? Lots of coaches travel lots of different roads to success, and those roads play a huge part in how they go about gaining their successes. So that's where we're going to go with the final frame as we take a look into how a coach's past and experiences in that past can play into the successes they've enjoyed in the present. Stand by, the third period's up next.
When it comes to overcoaching, players can only absorb so much. And, you know, we talk about having a system in place at a higher level. We talk about a lot of different things. But at the same time, at the NHL level, for example, we may give 3 or 4 keys to the game, not 10 or 12. Because by the time you get to the 10th or 12th one, they've forgotten the first 4. And it's reality. So you really key on the most important things that you would like to have your team pay attention to and go from there. The rest, you got to allow players to have some creativity in their game. You got to allow them to be able to go out there and use their speed and their skill level by not overthinking. We all know that overthinking will slow anybody down, whether it's execution, whether it's even in your skating, skating your pattern or what you want to do with your game itself. So I think it's extremely important here to minimize and give opportunities to players to be creative. By being creative, they also get to enjoy the game a lot more.
That was Claude Julien talking about overcoaching and just kind of how to let his players take over a little bit and just how to empower them to play their game. And I felt that was a good sort of wrap-up of what we did in the last period, especially since I did kind of talk a little bit about that last period. And just a good segue into this period is we're definitely going to talk a little bit more about him and his experiences and what got him to be a successful coach. So, in life, it's undeniable that we all travel different roads to get to our different successes. And what else is undeniable is that the journey and the lessons on that journey are the things that play the biggest roles in making our successes a reality. So many people and so many places play an integral role in making us the people that we are, and of course the people that we take into our endeavors and ultimately, hopefully, our successes. The NHL coaches that are featured in Behind the Bench have all had massive success at the highest level of hockey coaching. They have all traveled different roads to get to the top rung of coaching success. Some of them were players, some were not. Some of them played in the NHL, some didn't. Some of them coached junior hockey, some didn't. Some have multiple NHL coaching jobs before winning big, and some just got lucky in their first NHL job. It's quite the mixed bag, but it shows you there's no one true road. The paths are different, but the results are the same. But one thing is for certain, the coaches featured by Custance all would not be who they are today or have gotten to where they are today without some of those different journeys and experiences. I think the most unique path in the book to the pinnacle of the NHL coaching ranks is the one that Ken Hitchcock took. He was not really a player and never really got close to the pro ranks as a player. What he did have was a huge love of the game as he helped his dad, who was a rink manager, do the yeoman's work around the rink. He'd also learned how to be a coach of the game from mentorship and instruction that he received from the renowned University of Alberta coach, Claire Drake. The story goes that for 12 years, Hitch would spend his lunch breaks while working at a sporting goods store at the university's practices. Drake would give Hitch the lesson plans for the practice and then take the time afterwards to explain all the things that they did in the practice. Drake taught Hitch how to play a system of positional hockey whereby the entire team knows their role and can act as a unit towards the common goal of winning the game. Also, it cannot be understated that Drake mentored Hitch and took him under his wing, investing in him and teaching him the system that would win a Stanley Cup eventually. So it can really be said that Hitch didn't need to have played. He learned to be a coach from day one. So, good example of, hey, you don't need to be a player to be a coach. Still, playing experience can do a lot for those that go that route to become a coach. The basic idea that empathy grows from shared experiences is one that often helps a former player become a great coach. They know the struggles. They know what they would have wanted to hear in a certain situation because they were there or might have seen a certain scenario on the ice play out before and know a certain strategy that did or not work for his team when they were there because they saw it. That's what happened there. They're playing, so they could take that forward and realize what to do next time. Dan Bylsma played in 429 NHL games in parts of 9 seasons. He bounced up and down between the NHL and the minor leagues. He wasn't a scorer and wasn't seen. He was seen as a defensive forward who was strong on the PK. He was a hard worker who just was trying to keep himself in an NHL dressing room, and as such, learned a great deal about what it means to be the average player in the locker room, trying to make a decent living and just stay as long as possible with the NHL club. I think oftentimes these are the former players that make the best coaches because of the shared experiences they have with every player. Bylsma's rise as a coach with NHL success was fairly quick. He took over the Penguins in February of 2009, and they were struggling to even stay in the playoff picture. But he would take them on a tear of 40 points in 25 games, and then, of course, on to the Stanley Cup Finals and a Cup win. Sure, he had players like Crosby and Malkin, but what I think is genius about Bylsma was that he was able to get the players around them to start playing well, which made the difference. And, well, a red-hot Marc-Andre Fleury can help too. Still, for me, Bylsma showed his ability to reach the players who were just like him when he played, and that really made the difference. And then there are coaches who are successful because of their schemes and their coaching philosophy that revolve around the idea that they are pretty much teachers. That they have to communicate their plan effectively and teach what they want. The best example of that is when Custance interviews Bob Hartley. Hartley wasn't much of a player like Hitchcock. He really didn't grow up playing the game. He first got into coaching, though, while he was in high school. He was helping to teach mentally handicapped kids how to play as part of their program, and he was helping to teach them, and basically through that found a passion for coaching for the game. From there, he started to work at different hockey camps all over Canada and the U.S., and eventually ended up coaching junior in his hometown while working full-time at a windshield factory to keep making enough money for his family. Now, that's a heck of a work ethic, and it's these experiences of hard work that just start to get his sheer love of the game and his sheer love of the game that comes out in his coaching. He may not have the hockey prodigy background, but he did a great job to get to the top of the hockey world through hard work. All this has rubbed off on his players, and it's the reason he's been so successful. Basically, for me, Hartley's a guy who shows that being a good coach is about teaching players and reaching them to motivate them to do their best. His background is why he can do that, because he believes in the teaching aspect of coaching. And as we come to the end of this period, we can say there's a lot of diversity of background that can help fuel a coach's success. We've already talked about a few of them. For me, though, what is common between all the coaches featured in the book Behind the Bench is that they find their way to reach players and their backgrounds through their backgrounds and give them the perspectives that they have and have the empathy and the understanding to know how to do it. So that does it for the third period. Now to wrap it up in the post game right after this.
When we get the puck, we are playing fast and we are on the attack, okay? That's where you can get to them. If you can frustrate them from not spending so much time in the offensive zone and get on the attack and make them work under the hash marks there, we have a really good opportunity to do some good things here today, okay? So concentrate on your job. And you have to concentrate on above the puck. You have to tonight, okay? And we'll end up with some counter chances off of that. Everybody has to buy into that, okay? That's for Ray Cole.
That was the John Tortorella before a playoff game. Addressing the Blue Jackets, getting them pumped up and giving them just the simple game plan about what they want to do. But I love just his confidence and how he comes through. And I think it's an awesome, awesome period on what we've been talking about how all those things, all that personality, all that background a coach has can really motivate a team and goes into what they tell a team and how they want their team to play. So if you gather one thing from Behind the Bench and our discussion, it's that successes in NHL coaching is not simply a formula that you have to follow. There's no combination of players, experience, or hockey smarts is going to be the same at any given time of the career of any coach. A great coach needs to recognize this and work to shape their team and motivate them within the circumstances and the realities that they face at any one given time. The only way a coach can do this is through using the tools that they already have inside them. As previously discussed, there's no perfect set of tools that a coach must have. To me, it's all about how do they use the tools that they do have. To me, the idea that hockey greatness equates to a hockey coach is just wrong. Sure, you need to know the game, but it's no good if you can't teach it, if you can't motivate. I always think of Wayne Gretzky and his coaching experience with the Coyotes, and quite simply, it can be said that just because you're the best player ever doesn't mean that you're going to be the best coach ever. And unfortunately, Gretzky proved that. The coaches in Behind the Bench, to me, have had it all and use what they've got. Dan Bylsma was not a great NHL player, but he knows how to reach great players and even the not-so-great players. It's the perspective of what he's got in his arsenal. It's a commitment to not only be successful yourself, but make your players successful. Take them all individually and make them a group by doing what you can to show them your vision and have them buy into it. So I'm just going to say, as usual, my recommendation for the book is to pick it up. I don't know if I say anything different. I know you're probably like, sure, you say that every week. But this is a good one to pick up for many reasons. I will say the information in the book is a little dated as it was published in 2017, but the content is timeless. And the lessons and insights into the coaches speak for themselves. I can't say enough how much work Custance put into the book and how much it shows in every page. Also, I can't say enough how much in a book like this, it's great to see detail, but detail that doesn't drag on. The average page count for every coach profile in the book is around 25 pages or so, so that's pretty good. To me, that's not short, it's not long, and it really just kind of keeps you fresh as you read. I liked it because I could kind of do one coach in each sitting as a goal, and it just made it easier to do small little bites of the book and made things fly by. But most of all, the stories are great, and that's what I loved. And then again, if you listen to this show enough, you know that I love a good hockey story, and I'm sure you do too. So if you've got a chance, and you need something to read, obviously, go pick up Behind the Bench. You won't be disappointed. So alrighty then, I think that wraps it up for this week. I hope you enjoyed this look at Behind the Bench, and as always, I thank you for taking this journey with me. Also, if you've got any questions or comments, or you just want to talk hockey, feel free to email the show at fromthepointpodcast16@gmail.com. And also look us up and give us a follow on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. I post interesting facts each day, sometimes multiple times a day if you follow the page, about this week's featured book, and I'll also pretty much make it worth your while, hopefully. So please give us a follow if you've got a second. And finally, also, if you have another free second on top of that, give the show a subscribe on and a bit of love on your favorite place for podcasts. Reviews always help. Now it's time that I tell you, I'm going to take a break for a little bit. I figure we'll call 13 episodes good enough for the season, and I'm going to take a two-week break for a little bit to do some writing and a bit of regrouping. But I think I'll be ready to come back as good as ever on February 6th, which is where we will start up Black History Month, and we're going to have two special episodes to start the month out. The first is going to be an examination to one of the first best professional black hockey players, Herb Carnahy, in his autobiography, A Fly in a Pail of Milk. So, till then, thanks for listening as always. I appreciate you. This has been a great journey for me in this first season, and I'm looking forward to getting back with you in about 2 weeks. So, till then, stay safe, take care, and stay classy, hockey fans.